You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello.
Hello, chaps. Well, it's been a sad week in cycling. There's been a lot of racing going on, but the week really dominated and overshadowed by the tragic death of Michele Scarponi, the Italian rider hit by a car while training. We're going to talk about that in the first part of the podcast this week. We're also going to discuss Liège-Bastogne-Liège in part two. And in part three, a bit of looking ahead to the Tour of Yorkshire. And we're also not far from the Giro d'Italia now. We'll be looking ahead to that. But before we get on with any of that stuff, Lionel, can you give us the weekly news roundup, please?
I can indeed, Rich. As you say, the news this week of Michele Scarponi's death. He was killed while training early on Saturday morning near his home in Filotrano. He was hit by a van and died at the scene. He was 37 years old and had just returned home from the Tour of the Alps, where he won the opening stage and finished fourth overall. Scarponi is a Giro d'Italia champion, won the race in 2011 after Alberto Contador was stripped of the title following a positive test at the 2010 Tour de France. Scarponi also finished fourth overall in the Giro three times, but his career was not without doping controversy as well. He was part of the Liberty Seguros team, which was at the centre of the Operation Puerto scandal. He admitted to blood doping, or rather admitted to being a client of Dr. Eufemiano Fuentes, and he was banned for a total of 21 months. He returned to resume his career with Gianni Savio's team, Di Cui Giovanni Androni, and in 2009 he won the Tirreno Adriatico, which other than the Giro was probably his biggest race win. Later on rode for Lamprey and then joined Astana, where he was a key helper for Vincenzo Nibali when Nibali won the Tour in 2014 and the Giro last year. So the shadow of Scarponi's death did fall over Liège-Bastogne-Liège at the weekend, which was won for the fourth time by Alejandro Valverde. Valverde said that he would donate his prize money to the Scarponi family, which was a very nice touch. It's the third time that the Spaniard has done the Flèche Wallonne Liège-Bastogne-Liège double. Dan Martin was second, just as he was at Flèche Wallonne, and Michał Kwiatkowski was third. The women's race, very similar to Flèche Wallonne and the Amstel Gold in many ways, because Anna van der Breggen won again. She won solo this time ahead of Lizzie Deignan and Poland's Katarzyna Niewdoma. Those three were all on the podium, both at Flèche and Amstel. Although last week I said Annemiek van Vleuten was third at Amstel Gold race. In fact, she was joint third with Niewdoma because the photo finish couldn't split them. In other racing, the Tour of the Alps, which I've just mentioned, Geraint Thomas won there overall ahead of Thibaut Pinot, Domenico Pozzovivo, Scarponi, of course, and Mikel Landa. So Thomas is laying the foundations for a decent Giro, it appears, as is Pinot, who won a stage. Vincenzo Nibali's low-key build-up to the Giro continued. He won the Tour of Croatia. And talking of the Giro, Fabio Aru is definitely out. And Simon Yates will not ride for Orica Scott. He is going to go to the Tour de France to ride with Esteban Chavez, leaving Adam Yates to do the Giro. And the route for the Tour of Britain, or the OVO Energy Tour of Britain, as it will be known, has been unveiled. The race will take place from the 3rd to the 10th of September, and for the first time it will begin in Edinburgh. And for the first time, it will finish in Cardiff, so no London finish this year. The eight stages also take in North Lincolnshire and Nottinghamshire. And there is a 10-mile time trial, which will please Alex Dowsett, because it's in Essex, his home county, on stage five. So that's the Tour of Britain, starting in Edinburgh, finishing in Cardiff, and will likely be a great warm-up for the World Championships for some riders. So that's what's happened this week. Coming up over the next few days, we've got the Tour of Romandy starting and the Tour de Yorkshire, and then it's all set for the Giro.
Tour of Romandy and Tour de Yorkshire. That's an odd one, isn't it?
It is a bit. You'll have to take that up with the Tour de Yorkshire's marketing department.
Well, we'll hear from Sir Gary Verity in the final part of this week's podcast. In fact, looking ahead to the Tour of Yorkshire this year, which is coming up this weekend. As I mentioned at the start, though, it's been a very sad week in cycling with the death of Michele Scarponi. I think a shocking event, not least because we had all seen him in action so recently. You know, he was a very active rider, you know, and rode extremely well in the Tour of the Alps, was looking forward to the Giro d'Italia, where he was going to lead Astana in the absence of Fabio Aru, and, you know, clearly in very good form. And to wake up on Saturday morning and read, as many of us did on social media initially, that he had been killed was just almost too shocking for words. A life that had been, you know, lived so fully and so visibly so recently, just snuffed out in an instant. And it reminded us all of, I guess, how fragile life is, how dangerous the sport is, how dangerous cycling is. But Daniel, you knew Michele Scarponi a little bit through your contacts with Italian cycling. What can you tell us about him?
Well, I think first of all, Rich, maybe the most eloquent testimony about how he was regarded in Italian cycling was that I think the reaction of a lot of people on Saturday was not why this or what's happened. It was why him, why Scarponi of all people, because for a lot of people in the Italian peloton, he was the human Prozac pill. He was the one who lifted everyone's mood on whatever the occasion. In the peloton, he was the sort of harlequin court jester figure, very eccentric figure who we'd really got to know over the last few years. He started off his career in a small team, Acque Sapone, and then he signed for Liberty Seguros, spent a couple of years in Spain. And at that time, of course, Italy had much bigger stars. They had the likes of Paolo Bettini, Michele Bartoli was just finishing his career, Cipollini, Petacchi, and so forth and so forth. They really did rule the world. So Scarponi was not someone who particularly stood out. But then after his ban, as a result of his involvement in Operación Puerto, he came back and started to really get very good results in the Giro in particular. And as the wider public in Italy really got to know him, really got to know this very, as I said, this very eccentric, good-humoured figure who, you know, in interviews would always be larking around. He would ask you, did you want to do a serious interview or a non-serious interview? And he never seemed to be anything other than good-humoured, good-natured, and really japing around, I suppose. And I think over the last few years, the wider public outside of Italy have also got to know him as a result mainly of social media. And it's well documented, this sort of relationship he had with this macaw or parrot that lived around the corner from him in Filottrano, would land on his shoulder, and he would talk to on training rides, and he posted videos on social media. So yeah, I think the mood was so somber and so sad, and in Italian cycling, not only because they had lost one of their own, but they had lost Scarponi in particular.
Andy Hood, a while ago, a colleague of ours at Velo News, did a piece looking into the story with the macaw or the parrot, and Scarponi came out with a great line. He said he wasn't sure whether the parrot thought he was a cyclist or that Scarponi was a parrot, which I thought was a good line. And that those videos that he posted, and which were obviously being reposted a lot over the weekend, of Scarponi larking around, as you say, Daniel, with the bird, gave us an insight, I suppose, into another side of his character. You know, one of the things that struck me, you know, reflecting on him and his death, and you know, realizing the family that he left behind. He posted on Friday night a picture of him with his twin sons wearing the jerseys that he'd won at the Tour of the Alps, was how riders like Scarponi, perhaps we are all, or a lot of us are guilty of, you know, describing them in a certain way, putting them in a certain box. Those guys who've had doping bans in the past, you know, always when in mentioning them, always with that qualifier, that caveat, and it sort of dehumanizes them sometimes a little bit. It's not to excuse or condone the crime of doping, but sometimes it can obscure the fact that these guys are human beings as well, and they're multidimensional people with, you know, lots going on. And that's certainly one thing that I thought about over the weekend, that, you know, I'm guilty of it too. When I've spoken about Scarponi and some of his performances, I've probably always couched it in those terms that, you know, well, you know, remember his doping history or whatever, and not to ignore that or overlook that, but it reminds you that there's more to these people than one single fact from their history, I suppose.
Yeah, and we do tend to dehumanize them, and obviously a tragic incident like what happened, the one that happened at the weekend, does unfortunately humanize them in a very tragic way and reminds us that they are flesh and blood. And you know, obviously there has been this huge outpouring of grief, which is, again, testament to the number of people he touched. And I think one of the things that riders have been saying over the last couple of days is that Scarponi was someone who didn't really discriminate. He would treat a neo-pro domestique in the same way that he would treat a Contador or a Cavendish. He would always have a kind word or a funny line for someone. And I thought it was very sort of perceptive and almost touching what Warren Barguil, the French rider, said at the weekend when he was interviewed before Liège-Bastogne-Liège. He was asked about Scarponi, and he said that, you know, while everyone was obviously very upset in cycling, to most of us, unfortunately, in a few years' time, Scarponi will remain a sort of tragic footnote. And we all know the words to use in these situations now. We all know, we all, you know, feel it on a certain level. But the real tragedy here is, of course, his family. And, you know, you imagine a guy like that, how much life he brought to and how much humour and how much fun he brought to every day and every hour and every moment of every day. And it's not just a father, the father figure that that family's gonna miss. It's that fun and that the uniqueness, because he was so unusual and so much fun and so larger than life.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the real tragedy is the family, and the picture that he posted of him with his two boys is really kind of unbearably poignant to look at, them riding on his back wearing his jerseys that he'd been so proud to bring home. I guess what I was trying to say earlier was that we do sometimes tend to, in cycling in particular, look at it as a sport sort of populated by heroes or villains. You know, we take this very black or white view, and this very, we define people in these very simple, narrow terms. And it's a reminder that people are more than, you know, that whatever very limited, narrow view we have of them a lot of the time. I spoke to Chris Baldwin, who served as a press officer at Astana for a few years. He's been on the podcast before. He's moved on now. He works for Novo Nordisk, the diabetic team. But he had a few years at Astana and got to know Michele Scarponi pretty well, had some experiences with him, and was affected by his death, of course. So I spoke to Chris Baldwin yesterday, and here's what he remembers of Michele Scarponi.
I came into the sport and started working in it in 2011, and so anything before that, I wasn't such a close follower of it. So I didn't know his history, and I didn't know that he'd won the Giro d'Italia, for that matter. I just, you know, these were things that just didn't occur to me, even as years went on. So when he came and joined us in 2014 at Astana, my first impressions of, you know, this guy's a firecracker. This guy's, you know, he's a little guy. He's tiny. He's 5'4", you know, and he's 130 pounds, but he was just energy. He was just live and a live wire full of energy with every interaction he had. And the nice thing to know about that is that in this world of elite athletes, and you know, I worked with a team that won 3 Grand Tours in 3 years, and so there are some pretty elite dudes there. But in this world of elite athletes, Scarpa was the least concerned about being cool or being aloof or being reserved. And he literally went out of his way to get people to have fun and to relax and to enjoy their lives. It's as if he saw something happening to the boys in all of us as we turn into men and take this sport seriously as professionals, that he was trying to pull us all back to that boyhood joy of it. And that was my impression going forward. And every time I spoke to him from then on, he was engaging and he was full of life. And he always had something funny to say. And my Italian has improved over the years, but it's, you know, it's hard to keep up with him because he's a wordsmith. He's a clever, funny guy. He's like a Robin Williams type of punster. And as I got to speak Italian better and as I got to know him more, every time I had interaction with him, it was just always a joy and always a rewarding experience.
He seemed to be somebody who, and it's sort of borne out by the circumstances of his death. You know, he just got back from the Tour of the Alps. First thing the next morning, he's back out on his bike. He seemed to love his sport. He seemed to love riding his bike.
Yeah, and I would say he loved life more than anything. So for him, riding the bike was really just a means of expression for his life. And it was a place for him to come out and play with his friends. I think if he'd been a gifted football player, he would have been just the same. And if he'd been a darts player, or if he'd gone on to become a dentist in life, he was such a unique individual and such a vivacious and alive guy that my impression is that no matter what he did in life, he was the straw that stirred the drink.
How important was he in the team? We know he was a good rider, a very strong support rider in the mountains, but I think the impression that we're getting now is off the bike as well. And within the team, how important was he to keep the team gelled together and keep everybody smiling.
Yeah, absolutely. Probably more than anything. I know a couple of times I had talks with directors who would say things like, yeah, Scarpa is coming. This is going to be a good race. And talk to riders who are like, hey, is Scarpa here? Is he racing? Oh, good. We're going to have a good time. Because in the bus, in those mornings when you're goofing around making coffee and guys are lathering up their shorts and getting their rain booties on and getting ready for the race, the pressure, you know, for these elite guys is enormous. And if, you know, if they're not concentrating on lightening the mood, the stress just builds and builds and builds. And especially with, you know, I mean, Vincenzo's a wonderful guy and he's a terrific athlete, but the pressures on him are enormous. And so he really, more than anything, closed his world very tightly around him to control that and to keep it in check and to not let it get out of control. And Scarpa was the guy who came in and, you know, stuck a lever into the cracks in the pressure and released all of it and got rid of it. And so if he went to make a coffee, he made a big show of it and made a big comic performance of it. Or if he had to, you know, do something with the mechanics, it was for him, it was always a chance to lighten that mood and to just get us all to relax and enjoy the day and enjoy what it was we were doing. And that's the greatest thing, because you remember with him, we do this because it's fun. We don't do this because we want to have stress and furrow our brows and be frustrated at the complications that go into achieving it. We want to have fun. And that's what Scarpa did.
Since his death, there's been this outpouring of sympathy and appreciation for him as a human being, I suppose, with all these qualities. And we had some insight into that through the videos that he posted with the macaw. And, you know, he seemed like a fun guy. But nevertheless, in most of the stories or the podcasts we've done where we've mentioned him over the past few years, he's been one of those writers who's been mentioned, you know, with an addendum, a qualifier. You know, this is a guy who's had a couple of doping cases against him. How much did you feel that affected him? Did it affect him? I mean, did that affect his outlook on life, or was he pretty good at compartmentalizing some of these episodes in his own history?
Well, that's the wrong word. He didn't compartmentalize it. He processed it and he pushed it back out and he dealt with it and he did it in his own way. And I worked with a lot of these athletes and some of them have had, you know, past are tainted by these very same things, and some of them have served suspensions and some of them have gone away for a while and come back. And Scarpa, he didn't want to talk about it, of course, but he didn't deny it and he didn't want to put it down, and he was very gallant about it. The way he approached it was to say, you know, yes, this happened, this is a dark period in the history of the sport, we've paid our dues, we're moving on, and I'm going to enjoy it, and I'm not going to wear a hair shirt and live in punishment for the rest of my life. I've done this and I'm moving on. And he went on to great things. He went on to be a star lieutenant for Vincenzo Nibali. You saw him in last year's Giro. The reason I'm not the best commentator on the sport, but I can tell you my opinion is that the reason Vincenzo won the Giro last year is because of Michele Scarponi, directly. And in the years that I was with the team, he was the guy who pushed the team on and did the job for him. And for him, that was the redemption, I'm sure of it, and the joy of continuing in this sport that he loved and that everyone around him loved as well.
Do you have a favorite Scarponi memory or story?
I do. I've been thinking about it because it's, you know, I burst into tears every once in a while when I read something sad. But so I think, well, you know, Scarpa made everybody laugh, so it's better to remember him through laughter and through jokes and through all our various forms of humor, whether it's irony or buffoonery or whatever. And the one thing I remember is, it's in that video, it's in one of those videos, is that after stage five of the 2014 tour, the cobblestone stage, you know, when we started that stage, we had Vincenzo and Jakob, but we also had Louis Oester in the break, and we had big guys like Maxime Aglinski and Gruzdev, you know, plowing a furrow through those wet cobblestones. And, you know, Michele is a tiny little guy, and he's never, ever raced Paris-Roubaix before. There's no reason to send him up there. So for him, the cobbles were just this grim ordeal to be endured. And so at the beginning, everybody, you know, the staff was so focused on getting the tire pressures right and getting the spare bikes mounted and getting Louis up the road in the breakaway and making sure that the car was in contact and everything. And the instruction that they gave to Michele before the race was, Michele, just get to the finish. Doesn't matter. We don't care about your time. Just get to the finish. And Michele, you know, everybody just looked at him at the beginning of that stage, which really was the pivotal stage in that tour. But at the beginning of that stage, really, if anything, the focus and the theme of discussion before the race was, poor Michele, he he's going to have to ride the cobblestones in the rain today. How is this going to affect him? And he just had this sort of grim workaday laughter about him, just, you know, saying, okay, guys, I'm going to work. See you in a couple hours. And then when he finished and he came across, and it turned out that Vincenzo and Jakob had got away and Louis had pulled them across. And we had this fantastic minute and a half, 2 minutes on Contador at this point, and Froome had crashed out. And you know, and, oh, my God, this is going to happen. Scarponi comes up to the bus together with Vanotti, who's another guy who's not a cobblestone specialist. And they're soaked and dripping and muddy and wet and getting into the bus. And Michele just runs straight into the shower, shoes still on, helmet still on, and just dramatically and theatrically soaks himself in the nozzle of the wet shower to just warm up a little bit. And as it went on, you know, guys were coming in, they would do the same thing. They realized, well, it doesn't matter at this point. We'll get new clothes. We'll get new shoes. And they all sort of took their turns jumping in the shower to hose themselves off fully dressed. But then afterwards, and this is the memory that I have, and we got this on camera, everybody's still cold, and we had these terrible tracksuits that, you know, were just cheap, just ugly, awful things, and they weren't very warm. And so that's all the guys had to put on. They're putting on these tracksuits to try and get warm. Somebody got the idea of, hey, take the hair dryer and use that to get warm. And so, you know, Fuglsang, he dries his hair and gets himself warm, and Vanotti dries his hair and gets himself warm, and Scarponi says, God damn it, give me the hair dryer, it's my turn. And he grabs the hair dryer and he does his hair for a little bit, but then he, you know, sticks it down his trousers of his tracksuit, and he sticks it, you know, in the jacket of his tracksuit to warm up, but also to mug for the camera and to laugh and to show everybody, hey, you know, this is fun, come on guys, we're having a lot of fun, let's be goofy and let's be the boys again that we were when we started this sport.
So that was Chris Baldwin, former press officer at the Astana team, who knew Michele Scarponi well. And it's interesting listening to Chris there, Richard. He made the point that Scarponi didn't want to wear a hair shirt and just define himself as a doper, ex-doper, when he came back to the sport. And I suppose I'd echo what you said about the way that we watch riders who have been exposed for doping and have served punishments. And there is always, I guess, when you see somebody attacking and being aggressive in a race, there is a sort of an asterisk over their head as they're moving away from the group behind them. Certainly, I've been guilty of watching races like that. And I would say that over the years, you know, when Scarponi is putting the hammer down and really animating the race, I'm reminding myself that he was part of the Operation Puerto investigation and had been linked to the blood doping doctor. And I suppose, you know, that's the sort of tragedy of the era. So it's refreshing really to get to learn a bit more about Scarponi, you know, the impact and the way he made people feel. And I suppose really that is how he should be remembered. And despite his suspension, you know, he was always a very aggressive rider on the bike. He always animated races, and there have been plenty of stages, plenty of races where riders have just sort of hidden away in the wheels, and but for Scarponi we might well have been watching sort of quite boring races. Daniel, what are your memories of his actual racing career?
Yeah, I mean, just on, well, you mentioned Operación Puerto then. I mean, he was also unfortunately implicated very heavily with in the Padova investigation into Michele Ferrari. There were tapped, well, the recorded conversation with Michele Ferrari. But again, you know, we talk about morals and talk about ethics, but it's a complex, pixelated picture that you get of every individual. And Scarponi was also, you know, I mentioned the effect they had on other riders, but he's also known as a very generous guy, a great father, a great family man, but he's also done a lot of work, or he's tried to raise awareness about the plight of the people hit by the terrible earthquakes in central Italy over the past few months. He had taken part in a ride last autumn to raise money. His efforts for that cause were ongoing. And as a rider, he was very generous as well. He was someone I think was probably more at home helping other riders rather than riding for himself, not least because I suppose his riding style really contrasted with his personality. He was full, as we've said, he was a very vivacious character, a very eccentric character. He was actually, he was a bit of a diesel on the bike, was not a guy who would launch spectacular attacks, used to push very big gears, very strong climber, obviously. Renowned, unfortunately, for crashing as well. Crashed a lot on descents, including over the past few years, I think notably in the Tour de France that Vincenzo Nibali won. He had one spectacular crash in the Vosges, but would always get up and do his job on the front. And I think even, well, as important as his role in Vincenzo Nibali's Tour win in 2014 was his role in the Giro last year when on the stage to Sant'Anna di Vinadio, when Nibali really turned the race on its head and took the pink jersey off Esteban Chavez. Scarponi played an absolutely vital role up there on the Col de la Lombard, just above Isola 2000. And that was typical of him, really. And great longevity as well. He's 37 and showed no signs of slowing down. And that was partly, I think, due to his professionalism. A lot of people were surprised that he was up at 8 o'clock, tragically, on the day of his death, and he was already out riding, just hours after finishing the Tour of the Alps. But this was something he did often. He would send Nibali text messages because Nibali is well known to be someone who gets up late, and he would always sort of finish his training ride, Scarponi, in the middle of the morning, so partly so he could get back and see his family and spend time with his family. And he would always send Nibali messages to say, come on, Vincenzo, get up, move your backside. A fine professional and undoubtedly a talented athlete.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to our sponsor, Science and Sport. As ever, they are offering 20% to all listeners of the Cycling Podcast. If you go to the website scienceandsport.com and at the checkout, enter the code CPOD20, that's CPOD20, you'll get 20% off all your Science and Sport products. We're very, very grateful indeed for the support of Science and Sport, who obviously sponsor the weekly podcast and will, along with Rafa, be sponsoring us at the Giro d'Italia as well. We're looking forward to that. And there's a little bit, not a lull, but we've had the last of the big sort of one-day classics of the spring at the weekend there. Sunday, Deja Vu, Alejandro Valverde. As you mentioned, Lionel, he did the double once again, Flèche Wallonne on Wednesday, Liège-Bastogne-Liège on Sunday, and it was another same one too. They're very like the women's races, actually, the three, the Amstel Gold, Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, as you said, exactly the same podium in all three races for the women. And for the men, a 1-2 for Valverde and Dan Martin in Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And we spoke about Flèche Wallonne last week. I was there with Orla Chinoui. Probably didn't give Dan Martin the credit that he deserved for that performance. He's come into these races on a diet of, stage races, really, and he's ridden extremely well and went close to winning on Sunday, Liège-Bastogne-Liège. He attacked, it was a good attack, and he pulled back Davide Formolo, who'd got away a bit earlier for Cannondale Drapac, and that was a solid attack from him as well. But Valverde just got it right. I mean, Valverde was like a heat-seeking missile in the final 300, 400 metres. He waited, and when he went, nobody could live with him. And I don't know whether Dan Martin had waited and just marked Valverde, whether the result would have been different. I suspect not. The kick that Valverde has on those kind of finishes is just phenomenal. And at the age of 37, is he now? Doesn't seem to be fading at all. He's had a phenomenal season.
You have to feel a bit of sympathy for Dan Martin because he did, in both races, what he could and really had no other option open to him. If he'd waited, he would have been out sprinted by better finishers, and if he'd gone any earlier, he would have been caught sooner. And as it was, it's very easy, and it would be churlish to say that, it was his second mistimed attack of the week. Because really that was the only option that he had open to him. Valverde, in the absence of Philippe Gilbert, was the outstanding favourite. And, he does execute these victories extremely well. That's four wins in a row, is it, at Flèche Wallonne? Each of his victories on this climb up into Anse has been, not dissimilar to this. And very hard to see what the others could have done. I think from the point of view of the races, You know, if I was going to be the grumpy old man of the podcast, which is a role I'm quite happy to slip seamlessly into, you could have watched 5 minutes of Wednesday's race and 5 minutes of Sunday's race and really not missed anything of any worth. I mean, that's not to, you know, talk down the efforts of the riders who tried to make something happen. A couple of Cofidis riders, Anthony Perez and Stefan Rossetto, Tim Wellens of Lotto Soudal, and finally Davide Formolo. Omar Fraile as well tried something, but it was all in vain, and it was all just, you know, nobody had enough gas in the tank to really make something happen. And that, I think, is, even though the course had slightly fewer categorised climbs this year, I think it's just too hard and too frightening that anyone that does try something is inevitably going to run out of steam before they reach the end. And then if you're not Alejandro Valverde, then you're Michael Matthews, who's waiting for it to all come back together, and it just didn't in time.
Yeah, this is something we've said, Lionel, going back over a few years now, that the race is too hard, Liège is too hard. I mean, I sort of, well, tried to pick that theory apart a bit over the past couple of days, asked a few people, and some people agree with that, riders agree with that. But then, and this morning I spoke to a physiologist, La Française des Jeux physiologist Fred Grapp, and asked him the same question: is it simply too hard? And he said it's not the amount of climbing, because if you look at Liège, there are 4,500 meters of climbing. It's the equivalent of a big mountain stage in a Tour de France or a Giro d'Italia, but it's not the same, because the climbs are obviously much, much shorter, and you can organise a chase. I mean, one real characteristic of Liège, and particularly the finale of Liège, is that the climbs often don't end with big descents. They end with a false flat and the chance really for the peloton behind or teams behind to regroup and organise a chase. And also, it's a race that happens, that pans out quite slowly. It's sort of it's a casserole as opposed to the stir fry that is Paris-Roubaix. When moves go in Paris-Roubaix, it's a split second decision. Also because, you know, team cars are well behind, they often don't know what's happening in real time. They can't react. The riders are simply going at such high speeds that you have to really make split second decisions in a Paris-Roubaix or even a Tour of Flanders. Whereas in Liège, it feels like you can always correct things. You've always got 30 seconds, a minute to maybe confer with the team car and your direct sportif or teammates and decide whether you want to organise a chase. And you've always got that last chance saloon of the finale in Ans. But I think that the big change, and this is what Fred Grapp argued to me this morning, was that the difference between now and 15 years ago is doping, or lack of doping, or lack of the type of doping that was going on then. And he said that the reason he used to get moves going, notably on La Redoute, we talked about this last week, which is the iconic climb of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, is that using large quantities of EPO, riders could attack hard, but they could prolong their effort. And that's the crucial thing, that now riders might be able to launch big attacks and accelerate hard uphill, but generally they can't prolong these efforts beyond 20, 30, 40 seconds, and then they go over their lactate threshold, and the group behind is going at such high speed that they're inevitably caught. And the riders, of course, all know this, and they know that it's too big a risk, that they will burn out if they attack from a long way out, or they will get caught, so they simply don't bother. And then there's the carrot of World Tour points waiting at the end as well. And I think there are a lot of riders that go into Liège just thinking about survival and just thinking about sort of dribbling over the line in order to get some World Tour points, and everyone pats them on the back and says you've done a good ride, for most of the riders who are in that position. And they're not necessarily racing to win. They know before they start that it's a race that they can't win, and consequently it becomes very defensive.
Valverde though, chaps, I mean, he is an assassin, isn't he? I mean, say what you like about Valverde, his racing instinct is unsurpassed. You know, he had one bullet in both those races, Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and he just fired at exactly the right time. It's phenomenal to watch. I mean, Valverde, the form that he's in, and he's carried it from the stage races into the one-day races, and he's clearly, you know, it looks like he's going as well as he ever has done. He's going to win the Tour de France, isn't he?
Stunned silence there.
He's going to win the Tour de France. If he's going like that, he and Quintana, if he doesn't come out of the Giro too tired.
No, I don't think so. I mean, again, because in all seriousness,
it was a provocative question, Daniel.
Well, no, we think about Liège as this classic which draws the stage races into action. And Lieges of yore, the other day I watched one of the best Lieges, I think, of in last 20, 25 years, or one of the most exciting ones, which was the 1997 Napalm when Michele Bartoli was away with Alex Zülle and Laurent Jalabert. Was it 95
or 96? It was around that period, yeah.
anyway, we had Marco Pantani in that race attacking on Laradut. So, you know, this, and we have seen, even over the last few years, we've seen stage races at least more prominent, or at least riding Liège, and sometimes doing well there. But as I mentioned earlier, and as, you know, Fred Grapp, the FDJ physiologist, pointed out to me earlier, these are short climbs. They might be hard, they might be very steep, but there's a huge difference between a 10-minute effort and a 40-minute effort. And so I don't necessarily think we should read an awful lot into Liège as far as the Tour de France is concerned. Valverde has always come up short in the Tour de France, and there's no reason to think that he's not going to come up well short this time.
I mean, the Tour de France is a completely different animal. I mean,
Tour is a Tour.
The Tour is a Tour, and I think that's the first one of the year, Rich. Well done. Liège, Bastogne-Liège, and Flèche Wallonne are they're specialist territories, aren't they? And Valverde is to those climbs, the Mur de Huy and the one up into Anse, although they're not in the same league in terms of steepness, but, you know, they suit him just as well as clay court suited Rafa Nadal in his pomp. That's the issue, I think, with Liège, Bastogne-Liège. And I think maybe we'll see a slight change after next year, because according to reports in France, the contract between ASO and the town of Anse, or the suburb of Liège, Anse, which hosts the finish and has done for a number of years and has had this uphill finish for the last, what is it now, at least a decade, isn't it, this particular road that they use, we might see something different, because it was a race of very different character when it ran back into the centre of Liège and finished down by the river. If you make it so that the selection point is further out, then you see a kind of cat and mousey type finish. You give the chasers something to hope for, you give the break something to ride for, and you might see a bit more variety. Whereas finishing up on that particular climb, it was nailed on Alejandro Valverde right from the start, really, particularly with Gilbert's absence, as we said. And the other point, Daniel, you made was, I mean, when you look at the way the race unfolded and you see the sort of big two or three teams, Movistar had a lot of riders in good positions, Quick-Step Floors had a lot of riders in good positions. It just seems to me that if you really wanted to shake it right up, you could just cut the size of teams down to six.
Yeah, and also, Lionel, we often forget how big squads are as well. And these days, 28-man squads, that's something that you didn't used to see in professional cycling. Most teams had 15, 19 riders, so they could barely cover the classics and the Grand Tours. And there certainly wasn't the high degree of specialisation that there is now. I mean, most World Tour teams are put together with the Ardennes Classics, and certainly, obviously, all three Grand Tours very much in mind. So the average World Tour squad has got maybe 15 riders who would go well or do go well on hilly terrain like we see in Liège. So therefore, you can impose quite a high degree of control on races, whereas I think, you know, you only have to go back 20 years and look at some of the riders who were riding Liège. You got guys who were ostensibly classics specialists or cobble classics specialists thrown in, and, you know, they could do a job for the first 120 kilometres, but you didn't really see them much after that. Whereas now, as I say, the teams are, on the whole, very, very strong.
Hi, I'm James Knox of Team Wiggins, and you are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. I started racing because my brother was a cyclist whilst I was a runner, and I generally just became a fan of the sport and wanted to see what it was like racing bikes instead of running. My favourite ride is back home in Kendal. I can do a loop over Kirkstone Pass, round Ullswater, back over Shap, back down into Kendal, and then just a little drag home to where I live just south of Kendal. It's got like a lot of nice scenery and a few good climbs, so it's my favourite ride.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much, as ever, to Rafa, our main sponsor. We heard there from one of the riders from the Team Wiggins, James Knox, who obviously wears Rafa and wore it to second in under-23 Liège-Bastogne-Liège. recently, and then a really outstanding performance in the Tour of Croatia last week. He was eighth overall in some pretty distinguished company. That race, of course, won by Vincenzo Nibali in fairly unconvincing fashion, I thought. I mean, he won it in the end.
I thought you were going to say unconventional, Rich. It was very impressive.
It was unconventional as well. Unconventional and unconvincing. He won it with a bonus sprint. Who'd have thought it on the final stage? Beat the Caja Rural rider Jamie Rossen, who had taken the lead the day before on the Queen stage. So Nibali, he's often gone into Grand Tours looking a bit undercooked, hasn't he? I remember the year he won the Tour de France, he had a very poor Dauphiné before that, and he didn't really show much last year before the Giro, so not sure what we should read into Nibali's pretty average form so far this year ahead of the Giro. But yeah, James Knox, eighth overall, outstanding ride by him. And he's a young rider, only 21 years old. So that was good. Other racing going on. I mean, I said we're going to look ahead to the Tour de Yorkshire in this part of the podcast. We'll hear from Gary Verity. But there were other races last week, weren't there? The Tour of the Alps, most obviously, formerly the Giro del Trentino, and it was won by Geraint Thomas. Mikel Landa won that last year, and he didn't back that up at the Giro, so again, it's difficult to know what to read into that. But as you mentioned in the news roundup, Lionel, Geraint Thomas is having a very solid start to the year and is looking in good form going to the Giro, as is Thibaut Pinot.
Yeah, Rich, there were a few interesting pointers just 2 weeks ahead of the Giro. I mean, just going back to Nibali in Croatia, I think actually Bahrain Merida will be very much encouraged by his performance in Croatia. He was very worried after the Tirreno Adriatico in March, was not happy at all after that then, went away and has been training altitude and has come back, and the team are a lot more optimistic now, and I think he's a bit more optimistic as well. Obviously was riding with a very, very heavy heart on the last day in Croatia, and I think probably slightly inspired or wanted to certainly commemorate his friend Michele Scarponi, and that may be one reason why he was so desperate to take those bonus seconds and actually win the race overall. But I think he's shaping up okay. Thibaut Pinot is really loving riding in Italy. He's had an almost exclusively Italian program this year and has always talked in the past about how much he loves riding in Italy. You know, he's a huge Paris Saint-Germain fan, the Parisian football team Paris Saint-Germain. He went to visit them in the autumn, and his favorite player is the Italian midfielder Marco Verratti. And Verratti was called him the French Nibali. I'm not sure what the basis for that is. Anyway, that would be an interesting, well, probably not that interesting, probably just another way to annoy our listeners who, yeah, get very vexed by me mentioning football or golf every week. Anyway, I think he's shaping up really, really well for the Giro. Of course, we haven't seen much of Quintana in the last few weeks. He's been in Colombia training. Thomas, I'm curious to see what he does in the Giro. Obviously in really good form at the moment, but his Grand Tour record does not inspire too much confidence in me. As far as lasting the 3 weeks is concerned, I think he'll go very well for 10 days. I think it would not be a surprise at all to see him in the pink jersey at some point in the race, but I don't expect him to win, and I don't expect him to finish on the podium.
No, I mean, there's a whole 7 days of very difficult mountain stages at the end, and then they come in between the two time trials. The first one, the wine trial, Montefalco, would probably suit him perfectly. But then there's an awful lot of climbing to get over before the final time trial in Milan. And there's a lot of opportunities to come undone. And I think those last mountain stages, I mean, by the looks of it, looking through the Garibaldi, Daniel, I meant to ask you, actually, why is it called the Garibaldi, the Giro roadbook?
Did we not talk about this last week? Last year, sorry. I think, Lionel, that Giuseppe Garibaldi is famous as one of the...
Well, the biscuits are named after him as well, yeah.
Great biscuits.
Yeah, great biscuits. As famous for being one of the generals, or the main general who basically united Italy or contributed to the unification of Italy in the 1860s with a crusade, basically up the length of... He started, I think, in Sicily and ended up right in the north of Italy, and sort of swept across Italy, basically uniting the country. And consequently, I think Il Garibaldi, the road, the name of the road, but for the Giro d'Italia, refers to Garibaldi's campaign in 1861, I think it was.
Well, I think Geraint Thomas will be cursing Garibaldi because for unifying Italy, because I think if the Giro finished in Florence, he'd be perfectly happy. But going all the way up into the mountains in the north will probably be his undoing. But we'll wait and see. He's obviously going well, and you know, he's had a good week's work there. So if he's up there with Pino and co., you know, it bodes well. But the big unknown is just how good Nairo Quintana is going to be. And that's what we'll obviously find out when we get there.
We will indeed. Well, that's coming up next week. We're off to the Giro d'Italia. So there won't be a regular podcast next week. I think I'm right in saying that, Lionel. We will be coming from Sardinia on the Friday. That's the 5th of May, the day that the Giro starts. And that'll kick off our daily coverage from the Giro d'Italia, which we're very, very excited about. Another a bit of mentioning for a couple of other things we've got going on. We released this week our April episode of the cycling podcast Femina. That's mainly Orla and myself from Flesh Alone. We've got interviews with Anna van der Breggen, Ashley Moulman, Passio and others, and a long interview with Pauline Ferrand-Prévot. And also with Victoria Williamson, the British sprinter, who's on her way back from a terrible injury. Coming out this week, later this week, we've got our special on the Giro Friends special. Sign up to become a friend at thecyclingpodcast.com for just £10. That'll give you access to 11 special monthly, kind of monthly, roughly monthly episodes. And a bit more than that, we're offering a few bonusy things this year, and perhaps there'll be more of that at the Giro, details to be confirmed. But our Giro special was the three of us looking ahead to the Giro. We've got various interviews in there. And we're kind of looking back over the 100 or the 99 Giros that there are Giri that there have been up to this one, the 100th. And that was a fun episode to record. There's a lot. It's packed full of stuff. It's very long at the moment. We're just honing it, aren't we, chaps, at the moment? But that'll be released on Friday. And hope you enjoy it. Thecyclingpodcast.com if you want to sign up as a friend. Before that...
Have you forgotten something, Richard, about... I think we were going to honour the Tour de Yorkshire.
Well, I was getting on to that, Daniel. Give me a chance. I mean, are we not going to hear from Sir Gary Verity first on the Tour de Yorkshire? Because the Tour de Yorkshire is this weekend. Daniel will be heading up there. And I spoke to Gary Verity, who is the organiser, of course, the man that brought Tour de France to Yorkshire in 2014 and who is bringing the World Championships to Yorkshire in 2019. I spoke to him yesterday about this year's Tour de Yorkshire. Here he is, Gary Verity. So, Gary, Tour de Yorkshire almost upon us. What are the highlights that we should be looking out for this year?
Well, I think this year you've got three very different stages to what we've had other times, particularly the third stage for the real sort of cycling aficionados will capture the attention. We've called that stage the Yorkshire Terrier. It's 194 kilometres long, 3,500 metres of ascents, 8 categorised climbs, very, very tough stage. We're going from Bradford to Fox Valley, just north of Sheffield. Some iconic, classic British cycling. Côte de Shibden Wall. People will remember that cobble climb from the Kellogg's Tour of Britain. Probably the last time it was there. Some of the climbs that we did in the Tour of France, that particular stage. The first stage, we're going up another iconic Yorkshire hill, Garraby Hill. We've not been up that before. We're going to go to parts of the Yorkshire Wolds we've not been to before after the start in Bridlington, and we finish with the normal finish that we have in Scarborough. So that'll be something that a lot of people will look out for. Day two on Saturday, you've got the men's and the women's race on exactly the same stage, which is what the women have been asking for some time. So that we start in Tadcaster and come over the new bridge there. The previous bridge was washed away in the floods Christmas before last. And we're going to have the same finish line in Harrogate that we had for the Tour de France, the one where Cav unfortunately fell over just beforehand. And Marcel Kittel went on to win. So that's a tough stage as well. There's a bad climb coming out of Lofthouse, a really challenging climb. Anyone that's done it, the Côte de Lofthouse, going over towards Leighton Reservoir before you get to Massam, will really test both the women and the men.
People will be, it's still a few years away, but people will be looking for clues as to the World Championship course. I mean, I know that's maybe not this year, but in the next year or so will be a big draw for teams and riders coming to Yorkshire. Do you have in your mind an idea of what the course might include?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a clear idea of what the course will be, having spent a lot of time putting it together. There will be some clues. I guess it only becomes clear when you actually look back, when you know what the routes are and they've been published, to say, oh, well, okay, well, that was included in that and that was included in that and so forth.
Do you anticipate, though, that next year in particular, and obviously the year after, it will be a major draw for some of the riders who, you know, would be trying to win that title?
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure that that's the case. And, you know, every edition of the Tour de Yorkshire basically becomes a dress rehearsal for the world champs between now and obviously the event in 2019. If only to get used to riding on the style of Yorkshire's roads, which are quite different to other parts of continental Europe. You know, it's a different kind of tarmac here. It's grippy, as many people will be aware who are listening to this. And getting used to riding with large crowds as well, you know, because, I mean, that's something that we will undoubtedly bring to the party in 2019, these massive, massive crowds who turn out.
Gary, I know you've been to a lot of other events. I bumped into you at Pyrenees. I know you were at the Tour Down Under. You described that memorably as being like speed dating when you go to other events to get a taste of what they're like. Having been to quite a few in all parts of the world, is there another event that you particularly sort of take inspiration from or do things in a way that you'd like to emulate?
Well, I think you take something from each of them. I was at the Tour of Flanders the other week, and I think that's a great event. There's some great bits there that we'd like to plagiarise. The Tour Down Under, obviously our sister race, do some good work. Clearly, the most important race in our mind is the Tour de France, and there's a lot of things that Christian and the team do at the Tour de France that we've lifted and we do at our race. You know, there's always something to learn at whichever bike race you go to, however big or small, and the trick is to always keep learning and always trying to pinch some of the good ideas and see if you can bake them into your own event to try and make it even better year on year, and that's what we're trying to do this time round.
I know you had a big issue with team selection this year. There was a huge demand to take part. One of the teams that was left out was Team Wiggins, which caught a few people by surprise. Did that have anything to do with Bradley not finishing the race? I mean, did that come into the equation there at all?
Well, I mean, Bradley wasn't down to ride the race anyway this year, as obviously people will be aware. But we take a lot of things into account when we're selecting the teams. The nice thing from our point of view as organisers is that we had 49 teams apply for what was initially 33 places, and we increased the number of women's team to make it the same as the men, with 18 teams each to give them parity. So 49 teams for 36 places, and that means that, you know, some people are going to be frustrated and disappointed that they can't take part. But we hope that they'll continue to try and pitch in to take part other years, and we try and give everybody a fair crack of the whip. And we've had Team Wiggins for the last two editions, and we hope we'll see them again in the future.
Finally, Gary, I mean, what's the long term future for this event, and what, you know, what do you need in order to safeguard its long term future?
The most important thing is an extra day. We need to be a four-day men's race and a two-day women's race. We've tried to do as much as we can for women's cycling to help get it onto par with the men's sport. Really, we need to have two stages for the women, and in order to do that, we need to have four stages for the men. And in order to attract the best sprinters in the world, I need four stages for the men, so I can do two hilly stages and two flat stages. And I can even look at things like, you know, individual time trials or small team time trials as well.
So that was Gary Verity looking ahead to the Tour de Yorkshire, desperate for the event to go up to 4 days and for the women's race to go up to 2 days. Very odd that the stumbling block there appears to be British Cycling, but hopefully it will get the green light to extend or increase its days next year. And thinking of Tour de Yorkshire, we think of ASO, of course, and Christian Prudhomme, friend of the podcast, Christian Prudhomme. And it brings to mind, doesn't it, Daniel, one of the famous episodes in podcast history. Was it last year this was put together, this thing that we're about to revisit?
I'm hoping it was at least 10 years ago. Surely we've progressed.
I don't think podcasts existed 10 years ago.
It seems like a very long time ago.
Let's remind ourselves, shall we? Here's the, what do you call it? What's the official title?
I think it's saved on my computer as Prudy Ibiza Mix.
That's true, but the only places I saw that bunting was in Yorkshire. Was in Yorkshire.
I was not really concentrated on the race. I must confess. I was not really concentrated on the race. I must confess.
That bunting was in Yorkshire.
Humongous.
It was unbelievable.
Humongous.
That bunting.
I must confess.
It was unbelievable.
Humongous.
I must confess.
That bunting was in Yorkshire.
Oh, my ears. My ears are hurting. I think they're bleeding. That was deeply unpleasant. Anyway.
Have we just jeopardized our chances of winning the Listener's Choice Award at the British Podcast Awards by playing that?
Ah, that's this Saturday, isn't it?
It is. We're shortlisted in the sport category, and we'd like all our listeners to vote for us in the Listener's Choice category. Go to britishpodcastawards.com, and please do vote for us before the weekend.
We also might have a lawsuit on our hands, because that does, unfortunately, that final version of the Prudy Ibiza mix did contain a couple of unauthorized samples of American R&B singer Brian McKnight. But we did dodge the Jaws bullet last year, didn't we?
We haven't been done yet by Steven Spielberg. Remember last year you refused to sing Happy Birthday on my birthday. I'm delighted to confirm that once again I'll be at the Giro for my birthday with both of you guys, and I believe the rights issue on Happy Birthday has been resolved. And
it has been resolved.
Look forward this year to a full-throated rendition of Happy Birthday. That's on the 7th of May. Do tune in on the 7th of May. Actually, the 7th of May, is that the day that we're travelling from Sardinia? No, that's a Sunday, isn't it? Is that the day?
Daniel and I are flying to Sicily, and are you taking the overnight ferry?
Oh, I'm being left on my own to get a ferry from Sardinia to Sicily on my birthday.
Oh, that is sad, isn't it?
Well,
I tell you what, why don't we have a sort of unofficial birthday? A bit like the Queen has two birthdays, you can have an unofficial birthday on the 8th, which is also a rest day.
Okay. Let's do that. That sounds like a good plan.
Rich, moving on to more important matters. And on the issue of dates, I mentioned there were two things I wasn't sure about early in the podcast. The 1997 Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Zula, Jalabert, Bartoli, Pantani attack behind. 1860, Giuseppe Garibaldi and his military campaign up the length of Italy. There you go.
Glad you cleared that up. One thing we didn't mention when we were talking briefly there on the Tour de Yorkshire is who's riding it. Thomas Voeckler, defending champion, is riding. Apparently Samuel Sanchez is riding. Stephen Kruijswijk. He did that last year as well. Quite unusual sort of last minute preparation for the Giro.
Yeah, Kruijswijk is obviously repeating the formula that worked for him last year, because he has been at altitude for the last 10 days or so, or 2 weeks, doing a lot of kilometres. And then he went last year to Yorkshire and he's doing exactly the same thing.
And Nasser Bouhanni and Caleb Ewan are both riding as well for the sprints. Not that there's a lot of sprinting in Yorkshire, but anyway, should be good. Should be a good weekend's racing again. And I think that's all we've got for this week, chaps, isn't it? We should wrap things up, and the next time we speak to you, we'll be on Sardinia. So that's very exciting. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you.
Thanks to Will Jones for producing this week's episode. Thanks once again to Nick Christian and Jonathan Rowe for all their help in keeping the Cycling Podcast show on the road. And finally, keep your eyes open for this week's newsletter, which includes details of how to get a discount on tickets for Ned Bolting's Bikeology Recycled Tour in the autumn. If you're not on our mailing list, by which means you will receive our weekly newsletter, then why not? Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.